Pose this one to Marcia. I think this one's for you, Marcia. It's a clinical question. How you would respond to a patient who says that the skills... Oh, no, you already did that. Never mind.
Don't work.
Okay, so what about social media, Facebook, mobile phone, so forth, technologies being developed for people with BPD? What do you think about that? What's on the horizon? Are you thinking this is, what parts of this are folks thinking are good things? What worries do people have?
Oh, what a total fabulous question for me. I just so happened to buy a wonderful confluence of events, have a graduate student in clinical who has a PhD in computer science. And, you know, it's my, and not only that, but she's brilliant clinically. And so she and I have been talking a lot about, I believe, and I know Kelly does, because when we founded BTEC together, Kelly and I talked about how the future was going to be online, or at least in technology. National Institute of Mental Health, well, NIDA, National Institute of Drug Abuse right now actually doesn't even want grants that don't have technology in them. I mean, this is how far things have gone. And NIMH has now had as their first, one of their first requirements. They want technology. So my real feeling is this may be, first of all, it doesn't make any difference what we think about it. This is what's the future. I mean, you know, you can... What's this question? Can I? No. Can I be with this? That's the question to ask. I mean, the question is not to ask, do I want to be with it? Is it coming? But can I be with it? So my real feeling is we're developing. We started out by saying we're going to develop stuff to mobilize people to do homework. But actually, I believe that plain old vouchers and money will do that. But I do believe that we're going to have to get our treatments out on Facebook, Twitter, and all these other things. And the good news is the research on technology-based treatments is that if you talk to the therapist once during the whole treatment, it goes better than if you don't talk to them at all. So we may keep our jobs. So I'm all for it. I might even get Facebook, and I'm starting to think that maybe I could possibly get Twitter. I hear it's short and easy.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions.
That would be hilarious, wouldn't it, to have Marcia have a Twitter stream? I would love that.
You just
enter your random thoughts. I would subscribe in an instant.
Starting to self-invalidate. Oop, blocked that. I think that'd be excellent. Okay. A couple of questions, Marcia, about data and about studies in DBT for you. I'm going to put these two together. One is the definition of expert. How do you operationalize that in the treatment by expert study? And data comparing long-term outcomes for DBT versus psychodynamic or other therapies. Long-term meaning like 5 years or longer.
Okay, expert therapy, that's a really good question because how would you define it? So the way we did it was we called every head, first of all, we called the attendings and all the inpatient units because they actually know who's good in town by the people who come in. We called the heads of all the training programs. We called the heads of directors of clinics. And we basically called all the leaders, I mean loads of leaders in Seattle. And we said, we are looking for people who are extremely good with difficult to treat patients, basically. And we told them we were doing a study on suicide borderline personality disorder, and we wanted experts. Then what we did was all these names came in. I think it was 99 names. And we sent them all a letter and said, you've been nominated as community expert. And then we asked them what they did, what kind of therapy they did. And we had them, we had a rating scale, and we asked them to describe what they did, which was an extraordinarily good idea that we did that. And we went through and we coded them from extreme on one end, they were absolutely behavioral, totally behavioral, did nothing but behavior therapy, to the other end where they had no behavior therapy whatsoever, they were totally something else and everything, and then we graded them in the middle. And what we found out was cognitive behavioral therapists and psychodynamic therapists often called themselves cognitive therapists, which is true, of course. And so we eliminated everyone who was cognitive behavioral and kept everybody who wasn't. So that's how that was. We matched on years of experience, degree, and gender, and I forget what else. So in general, and we hired the Institute of Psychoanalysis, which is very prestigious in Seattle, and we hired people there, their director of training, to be a supervisor whose job wasn't to make them do psychoanalysis, but to assist them in doing the very best treatment they could according to their own model. And they could do anything. They could have pharmacotherapy. They could put them in therapy every day. They could put them in the hospital. They could have them in groups. They could do what we told them. We wanted them to do the very best therapy. So that's who they were. Now, long term, you know, it's really interesting. First of all, I consider 1 year pretty long term, but it's definitely not 5 years. Our problem is we went to the National Institute of Mental Health, asked for, you know, for them to fund a follow-up study, and they said they weren't interested. So I think that in many ways that the amount of money that the federal government would spend on that is not the kind of money they want to spend. They'd rather have me improve the treatment. And I am I'm a victim of the money that I get. There's no good reason to believe it would be, first of all, since there's no good reason to believe we wouldn't have good long-term outcomes, because behavior therapy is known to have very good long-term outcomes. So, and this is just behavior therapy.
Question for Dr. Kelly Kerner. Tell a little bit about the supervision and training that you offer online and team building work when it's done remotely online. Tell a little bit about your program.
So I'll just say a little bit, but then I would just invite, let me give you my email address. So if you're interested in stuff, you know how to get me. So k.kerner, K-O-E-R-N-E-R, at comcast.net. So k. dot, and then my last name, Kerner, at comcast.net. So I've been experimenting with how can you do stuff where people don't have to take off a bunch of time from work, you know, to be able to get training. And there's also some good evidence about spaced practice. So to go away for 2 days and try to cram it all in your brain versus could you, you know, pick up an hour, could you pick up an hour like that and spread it out over time and really try integrating it and then get feedback on how it's going. So that's the model we're working on. There's a learning community. If you Google, you can get the www.practiceground.org. There's a group of us who kind of join together to learn evidence-based practices together. And it's got learning little bite-sized, you know, 15-minute clips or hour-long lectures or that. And it's got a pretty strong DBT focus since I'm the facilitator. And there's one thing that's already running, which is that. It's just a learning community, and I can give you more, and you can look at the website. But this team stuff, this is really interesting to me. We're trying to experiment because you've got to have a way of getting skilled up, and then you have to have a way of having a team in an ongoing way. And so I would say probably starting in September, we're going to try a new program, which is you get skilled up, like you have little bite-sized things you're learning, and you get assigned or you link up with peers to form a team so you could study together. And so that will be posted on the web. Right now everything is within the existing learning community, but in the fall is when we're going to be rolling out the new thing. So does that help? Is that enough? Yeah? Okay. You're welcome to write me. It always feels too much like a plug, so, you know, I just hesitate. So if you're interested, feel free to write. I'm happy to tell you more or figure out what you need and direct you to somebody else, too. Kelly has some scruples. I'm like, give me your money, give me your talent now.
Okay, so I think this question is for Marie-Paul and Harry, mostly. Well, it's actually a couple of questions I'm going to try to put together here. And they have to do with, under what circumstances might something like family connections be recommended? When would you recommend it? And would it also make sense if somebody's already done a friends and family group? How are they the same? How are they different? I think the answer there is, well, I don't know the answer to that. We'll let everybody else answer that. And what about if you've got a, what if it's your parent who has BPD? Would that be appropriate?
So I'll start with the second one, the question about the difference between family connections and a friend and family support group. There are three very distinct components to a family connections program. I'm sorry?
She's talking about your group.
It's not a support group, though. I think so, yeah.
Oh.
Mary Paul doesn't know about your group.
So I don't know about that.
Yeah.
So I can't speak clearly about this, and perhaps so I'll just tell you what family connections is, and then perhaps I can let you address the other one. There are three distinct components to the family connections group. It is a support group. We do spend quite a bit of time sharing what happened, what we tried to do, whether we tried to apply the skills, how it felt, the kind of results we had, the kind of weeks we had. So that's the first part. The second part is we try to disseminate the most current knowledge, and we get that from any ABPD or from practitioners, right? And so we disseminate that. And then, of course, the third part, which is really, really important, is the skills. So we teach skills. We try to teach skills, but it really comes from other parents who have tried the skills and who have had success with that. So so a lot of people who experience the Family Connections program talk about those three things as being particularly helpful to them and the combination of that allowing them. And it's a 12-week program. And so the ability to practice again and again and to fail and then to start succeeding and to build on that is very important. All right, the brain is gone. Let's, yeah.
Okay, one of the actual difference, probably, maybe the biggest difference between friends and family connection is family connection is really geared towards borderline personality disorder. Friends and family is for anyone it's not really for a specific disorder. It's if you could have your boss could be a problem, or your child could be a problem, or your neighbor could be a problem, or they could be borderline or suicidal. We have a lot of them. I would say the majority have very disordered relatives, let's put it that way. But it could be anything. But the way we run it, I teach this. We've done this with therapists. We now do it with friends and family. We do it with clients. It is identical to exactly what we teach clients. It's the only difference is clients are two-hour sessions and friends and family is 90 minutes. And the first half is homework review, which is the same thing as tell us what happened. So we review homework. We treat them the same way our clients are. You didn't do your homework. What got in the way? And the second half is teaching new skills. And they learn all the exact same skills in the exact same order in the exact same handouts as our clients do. And the only real rule that we have is we have a meeting with everyone ahead of time. We run a little bit like Al-Anon, which is you're not here to change this other person in your life. And that's not going to be the focus, and that's not what we're going to do. And we always have an individual meeting ahead of time to make sure people are clear. They're not coming in to learn how to be the therapist to another person. And we've only had, the whole time I think that we've been doing, this is our, if you're a clinic and need to make money, this is the way to do it. Because we always have a waiting list for friends and family. And we've only had one person drop out, and they dropped out for this, drop out over this. One person finally got so upset that we weren't helping them with their family. So the difference is, I think, it's longer, I think, because it goes 26 weeks. And people can, we're amazed at how many people want to take it a second 26 weeks. It's been a big surprise to me. And people come in, and then they want to come in with their wife or husband or someone else. And so, and it's highly recommended in Seattle. A lot of us recommend that if you've got your child or your parent or relative in DBT, then it's often a very good idea to get the family member to also come in. So that's the difference. And it's not at all related to a disorder.
And Marcia, yours is run by therapists?
Well, ours is run, actually, to be honest with you, it's run by graduate students. Okay. And but it could be run by therapists, but it could be run by non-therapists. I mean, you know, I'm trying to get my sister, for example, to become a Friends and Family, but I think Peary has abducted her. My sister's in love with Peary and wants to do Friends and Family Connections. So, but I think you could do it. Almost anyone could do it. I mean, you know, but you have to have somebody who knows the skills. So you have to have taken them and learned them.
Whereas ours is run almost exclusively by parents, people who have taken the class.
We have some
professionals.
I like
yes,
that thinking.
And then, of course, we have some professionals. And so those are people who must have taken the class and then who must have attended the training that Alan provides yearly. And we always have co-leaders, two people. So a few different little things. And I think ours is a little bit of a simplified version because parents have to have something tangible to pass on to others. So
my opinion is we should start getting some of these families to come in to start being teachers.
Oh, I tell you.
I mean, that's a great idea because that would really solve a lot of our life problems.
Another part of the question was about spouses and about parents, right, Alan? And as we were saying just before lunch, actually, things have changed enormously in the 4 years that I personally have been co-facilitating these groups. It used to be mostly parents, mostly of daughters. Very slowly, we started seeing parents of sons. We started to see couples come in as opposed to mothers. And then some siblings started coming. And now the groups are very varied and include spouses and are starting just now to include sons and daughters of parents who are suspected, often undiagnosed officially, but parents who have difficulty with their emotion regulation. It makes for an interesting group, you know, when you have such different topics. We really have to sort of find the common thread, but inevitably everybody finds. We even had a neighbor in our most recent group of somebody whose connections with her family were completely broken, and the neighbor was just trying to help a lot and came to the group. So
I want to say something about whether to take both. You certainly would not take both to learn skills. I mean, you might learn more in Friends and Family because we cover more of the terrain. But if what you want to do, though, is get involved in the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, or if you yourself want to become a skills trainer, certainly at least right at this very moment, because I never thought of figuring out how to get all the people who come to become trainers so today. So right now, if you want to get into the business, if you're mission-driven and want to help and want to end up yourself being a person who trains, then Family Connections would obviously be a better choice because you have this big national organization that you can get involved in, which is really wonderful. And we, and Friends and Family, we run it. A lot of the places in Seattle now have Friends and Family, but we're not involved in a big national organization, and we don't train the people who come to do it. Like, I want more Alzheimer families, for example, caregivers, to come to our Friends and Family. I'd like to have people from Microsoft come, who I know have troublesome bosses, so I hear. So I figure, you know, we're much more open and not specialized.
Well, we're on the topic of families. There's a couple of other family questions I'll post to everybody. These are related. How do you deal with somebody, a family member, who has BPD that when you try to be validating, even they are explosive and angry? And then related to that is, how do you deal with a family member that you think has BPD but refuses to get help? I think those are not unrelated questions.
I think you should answer that.
Okay. I was trying to pawn it off on somebody else. I think that, you know, the issue about if somebody is responding in an escalating way when you're trying to validate, that means that there's a disconnect. Our data would say that the attempt to validate isn't working. So the good intentions are there, but it's not landing, right? Now, sometimes the metaphor I use is it's kind of like sometimes you've got the person says they're on fire, and you've got a bucket, you've run and got a bucket of water, and you go to throw it, and it seems like they put up an umbrella. Okay. Now, of course, they're not intentionally putting up an umbrella. They really want the fire to get out, but it just looks like one more threat. Okay. So it's not really validating if it doesn't land. It doesn't soothe if it doesn't land. And so I would simply say, you know, back up and slow down. Make sure it's clear that it's not a threat. Use some of Kelly's suggestions in terms of sit with their suffering a little bit and be more gentle in the validation for a while before going back to the more verbal kind of validation. And if part of that suffering is that they're not getting help, that you think they would benefit from some kind of treatment and they're not, very slowly and gently disclose that from a position of love and acceptance, not when they're doing something that drives you crazy, but when you're loving them and when you're feeling close to them. I know that's when you don't want to rock the boat, but that's when you're most likely to be understood. Again, I can't emphasize enough the importance of genuineness and gentleness while still being descriptive and honest. The dialectics of the validation is what I would recommend in a very short version of that.
Let me say one. I do have to say, though, that sometimes the reason validation doesn't work is because the person's on fire. Now, notice how he was validating a person on fire. He got a pail of water. However, what a lot of us do is a person's on fire and we say, oh, I see you're hot. This is likely to cause an escalation.
Good point.
Can I add a quick little something, Alan, to that?
Sure,
the
please.
Last quote that I gave you guys earlier in the day is actually from a family whose daughter has two children and lives at home with the parents. And she refused, and life has been really very, very difficult for them. And so this was the quote where the mother actually validated her child, and it worked. You know, and it was the first time that it worked. But as Marcia talked about earlier, you know, you start to change a little something in the family situation, and then change occurs. And it's not to say that everything will become miraculously fine with the parents just doing the work, but with the parents doing this work, she might, in fact, become more amenable to perhaps some treatment down the road. So the step-by-step part on the family side is really important as well. Just because the patient refuses treatment doesn't mean that there are no options. It just means that it might take a little longer.
I do also want to say, though, I'm now doing counseling, so to speak, with a person who's a person in her 50s whose sister appears to be borderline personality disorder, and there's not a chance that that sister is going to get treatment, as far as we can tell. And I have another very close friend who has a sister who also really refuses everything offered. And to a certain extent, this is the, you know, can I sit with it? This is, you know, we have to recognize that people have a right not to get treatment. And there's, you know, their goals are their goals. Our problem is we often feel guilty if we don't keep trying to help them without recognizing that we also have to observe some sort of limits and that we can't help every single person, nor can we get them to be the kind of person we think they ought to be or should be, or that being happier would be better for them. And I see this a lot. This one person I see, I will say that I said this to her. So this really fits the discussion. I said, this, the one I'm counseling, the sister is actually doing unbelievably destructive things. The police won't even go to the person's house. And she's taking out a second mortgage and she's taking care of the mother. I mean, it's really a tragic situation. And so I said, the client was, well, should I call the police? Should I do this? Should I do that? And I said, you know, I think you need to stop all these efforts of changing, and you just need at every single moment to find the nugget of gold in the cup of sand. And just look for something to say something positive, to validate. In this, you know, there's always a nugget of gold in the sand. That's the nugget of gold which we can all find, and just skip everything else, and everybody tolerate it. All the bad, all this painful stuff she does, just start saying, that's the disorder, that's happening, that's the habit. I can tolerate it. And practice this other. So there's times when you make yourself miserable thinking that somehow you're going to get a person in therapy. I think on the other hand, if they want to be in therapy and you can pay for it and they can't pay for it. I'm all for helping people.
I'd like to know, I mean, this is resonating.
A couple of questions related for Katie. So at this point, I think there's a couple of people want to know, so is it true that there's no such thing as anybody who's an accredited therapist or certified therapist or an accredited program? And what about a pilot study that was done for DEEP? What about that? Somebody knows something about pilot studies? That's one. Related is, how would you go about getting trained to be accredited as a program, or trained to be more adhering? How do you go about doing that? And including that there's some questions nationally, like in different places, but also what about if you're here in Seattle? How would you get supervision?
Be kind. I'm horrifically jet-lagged. Let's go in chunks.
Oh, sorry. All right. Start with the first one.
Okay. Starting with the first one. It is a fact that right now there is no such thing as a certified DBT therapist or an accredited DBT program within the nomenclature of the University of Washington. I'm sure it's entirely possible that somebody has labeled something as certified DBT or accredited DBT. I'm very sure that those words probably are out there, but in terms of the system that's recognized by Marsha Linehan as the developer of DBT, it doesn't exist. Not even Marsha is a certified DBT therapist, which makes it a little challenging. So there will be a point in time where we're going to have to take care of that.
Perhaps we should start with one person being certified.
Certified. Yeah. And I can say that we've at least both taken the exam. So we've both passed that, so that's really good news. And we both have had our tapes coded for adherence, and we've both passed that, so that's really good news. Thank you. We both have had supervision from somebody that is recognized by the treatment developer for DBT, so that's good news. So what's missing for us and for quite a few other folks is that we haven't yet filled out the application to become certified, and we haven't yet found the body that will actually hold the power to issue the certification. All of this is exactly the same when we now apply it to the idea of program accreditation. It doesn't yet exist, but are there many programs that if we have this body to provide that, yes, there will be programs who can be almost immediately accredited. Okay, now I'm ready for the next one.
Terrific. How would someone go about getting the information that you put up there that would help them start to move toward becoming what ultimately could be an accredited program and an adhering therapist?
Thank you. Such functional validation and spoon-feeding me today. The website that I put up, and I will make this information available with the help of Perry and NEA BPD, we have a website that details a variety of pieces of information about the process, including some self-study materials, both for preparing your programs to be accredited, as well as for individual therapists to prepare to take the exam, sort of know whether or not you're ready in terms of the knowledge, content, and applied practice elements, but also in terms of, do you actually have those prerequisites in place?
The thing that I want to be clear about is this. There are a million places that a person can get trained in DBT. And as long as it's somewhat of a valid training program. I mean, I do have to say, as maybe some of you know, there are people out there teaching a treatment called DBT that actually is a completely different treatment. I know that because I've had presentations given to me of people who said they were doing DBT, and I said, believe me, that's not DBT. Well, I learned it. And so there's another, I forget what it means, but someone else uses the term DBT to mean something. They don't even mean dialectical behavior therapy. So you want to be careful about that. But as long as it's in effect somewhat like an accredited training group, and more than likely we'll have a list or people will submit lists. But, you know, academic settings, all the graduate schools in the world, I'm sure will be fine. Many training groups and, you know, it's not, there won't be like you have to come to us or you have to come to people in this room, mainly because it's going to be an international program anyway. So it's just a question of having some behavioral training or at least knowing something about behavioral interventions and knowing something about DBT, and the exams really are right out of the book. If you can memorize the book, you can pass the exam.
I think that several people want to know, though, for now, it sounds like accreditation and certification are still months, if not more, away. For now, how does your average person with BPD or your average family member who loves somebody with BPD, how do they know whether the provider is actually providing good, solid DBT, or at least in that direction, as opposed to something that's called DBT and maybe has elements but isn't very good?
Yeah.
How do they know?
Well it's hard. I think that's what we're trying to that's what we're, of course, the reason why we want to have this in place is, I mean, the last thing you need to be wrestling with when you or a family member is desperate for help is trying to evaluate whether or not you're at a place where you can get it. But in the interim, I think one does the best they can, which is to look at first, what are the credentials of the provider? Is this somebody who has a degree, license, and scope of practice where they can provide these elements of treatment? That would be the first place to look. The next would be to find out what was the method by which they were trained. Did they have supervised practice in learning how to do DBT? In other words, one would do very much the same thing if you found out that somebody in your family needed to have a heart transplant. You would want to make sure that...
I can do that.
You could do a heart transplant?
I could do that. I've seen it. I've seen it in the movies.
You've seen it on in the movies, so you could do it. Absolutely.
I know what a scalpel is.
You only really need to watch one TV show, and you can do it.
But sorry, I don't mean to be so irreverent, but
it's absolutely the same thing.
It is the same thing.
You have to call and you have to find out, you know, who is qualified to do it, and most therapists will answer quite honestly about how they got their training, but most of us forget to ask the questions. You know, where did you learn how to do this particular intervention, and what's your experience?
I was going to say I have a little short list. I have people ask me this, so I have my short list. I say ask, do they have a skills training group? Ask, do they work with a team? Ask where they got their training. And then ask if they're going to be your individual therapist, do they use a diary card? Do they do chain analysis? And do they have some sort of targeting? And so you could kind of, just a little quick, if they say yes to that, then at least it seems credible. They're trying.
This, my opinion is this. First of all, if they say they were trained by me, ask them if they ever talked to me. I'm not kidding. People say they were trained by me nonstop who came to a workshop. Second, a two-day workshop is not training in DBT. So anyone who only went to workshops, you know, a two-day is not trained. They either need to be trained by a person that's a credible person in an academic training program that's reasonably credible. If a person is a really well-trained behavior therapist, I actually believe the average really well-trained behavior therapist can pick up DBT very easily. So if they went somewhere and got more than one course, in other words, a whole curriculum that was behavior therapy, and they obviously they have to have all these things. I'm not disputing anything said. I'm saying that a workshop is not training. A workshop is designed to help you decide whether you want to get it. And the other thing, I'm not kidding, buy the treatment manuals yourself. I have more clients call me up, and they say, my therapist is not doing DBT. I say, really? How'd you know? they say, well, I'm reading the book, and she's not doing it. And I said, well, I said, good for you. Go in, take that book, get your a copy for your therapist, take it in, and you and your therapist go over the book and get them to do it. And then I'm very serious. Get the books. Read the book, and then tell the therapist how to do it. And that might be your only hope in rural areas and other places. And so, you know, you may have to, the therapist may have to learn it with your loved ones. But, you know, you'd be amazed how many people could maybe do that. But be sure to get the manual. I can't say get the manual. We have to retract those statements.
I can say it.
I make, I want to say that I get royalties off my books and I make money. So you have to take it with a grain of salt here.
I think the other thing, that, as Marcia was saying, you may have to advocate and teach the therapist how to do the treatment. You know, it's kind of like if you're out in the middle of a hike in the middle of the Sierra Nevadas, you might...
That's me.
You might just allow Alan to do, you know, a tracheotomy, even though he might not have formal training. It's like, you might need to teach that person to do it on the fly.
I appreciate your confidence. That's a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea. So, Katie, the other question here about this is, what happens when somebody says they're doing DBT, but they're really not? And the answer to that, I could tell you, is, you know what, the reason that Katie's jet lag is she's a little bit like Santa Claus, but it's in like the dark shadow of Santa Claus. She travels around by stealth of night and mixes up their drawers in their dresser and gives them the wrong toothpaste and really makes their life miserable. But that's really the only consequence right now.
No, it's true. I mean, this is the thing, is that even once there is a body to provide that fairy wand of are you or are you not, it doesn't come with any kind of, you know, punitive power. I wish we could do something more powerful, but at this juncture, the best we have is just to be knowledgeable.
I also want to make a point that what a lot of therapists are now doing is they say they're doing DBT when they're really doing another therapy with a little tiny bit of DBT in it. The reason I know this guy get asked to testify at trials for these people, and I refuse, because I say, you know, if you're going to do psychodynamic therapy, do it by the book. If you're going to do DBT, do it by the book. And the thing to remember is the minute you leave an evidence-based treatment and change it, you're no longer in an evidence-based treatment. You're now in a treatment that has no empirical data that it works.
And this is true when people marry to evidence-based practice.
Oh, yeah.
There's a belief that now the whole thing is evidence-based. But that's not the truth
either. Putting mentalization together with DBT is the favorite right at the moment on the East Coast. And I keep saying to them, I say, mentalization is another treatment. It's unclear whether it's evidence-based. It's got two studies, very nice studies, actually, incredibly, in my opinion, very good studies of effectiveness. It just hadn't been done by an independent site yet. And so that's one treatment, and DBT is another. And so what a lot of people do is they say, okay, we're going to do that treatment is called mentalization. We're going to do mentalization plus DBT with the same person all the time. And I say, you know, do either mentalization or do DBT, but there's no evidence that putting these together is now an effective treatment. In the same way that putting a person who has research data on one drug and research data on another drug, then we put the two drugs into the same person. We now don't know whether you have an evidence-based pharmacotherapy or not because we don't know how they're interacting together. So you want to really be careful about the DBT light, that's what it's called usually. Now, that being said, let me just tell you, there's data for DBT skills training with a team and done using DBT strategies. So a DBT treatment team plus DBT skills by a person trained in DBT, there's actually a fair amount of evidence now that that is, in fact, effective. So you don't want to avoid, and if that's what's available, take it.
There's a couple of questions here that are connected that I think are addressed to everybody, but perhaps you in particular, Marcia, having to do with long-term outcomes for people with BPD, how well they could be expected to do in their life. Do people actually recover? Is it possible to recover, to not have BPD anymore? Is it possible that somebody with BPD could go on to become a therapist, specializing in working with people with BPD? Is that possible or desirable or a bad idea? Well, let's start with that.
Well, I'm going to answer this by telling you a little story. One of my very favorite clients came to me on a hospital airplane from the East Coast. And we went through about, I think, 4 or 5 years of therapy. She was, you know, the police were running down the streets behind her with blood trailing behind her and knife, and she was being found behind dumpsters, unconscious, and thank God she got found or she would have been dead. And she was in and out of hospitals all the time. And she quit school about, you know, well, literally every quarter for a really long time, and quit everything else that she ever did for a long time. But I finally actually got her through college, got her into a job. She moved down to California, got a great job as a teacher, and really was fabulous. The actual problem with her was she was not only borderline personality disorder, but also schizoaffective. So I was down visiting, and I just adore her, and she feels the same about me. And so whenever she's in Seattle, we go out to dinner or lunch or something, and if I'm where she is, we do the same. So I'm down in California at this talk, and I'm giving this talk, and she comes and talks to me about the tragedy of the schizoaffective disorder, where she had a lot of illusions and they couldn't get the medication straight. She's now being not able to work full time. And I'm listening to this whole thing. So I, being at least 5 times more upset with her, and sitting there crying as I'm talking to her. And she says to me, "Marcia, don't be so upset. This is nowhere near as bad as borderline personality disorder was." And so, you know, I keep reading. So that's a good point, you know, if people get over it. I have another patient right now who has another tragedy. She had a child who, it turns out, to have a fatal disorder, probably won't leave till 3. She came from inpatient hospitals, ECT shock, everything you can think of treatment, before she got to me. She's now unbelievably well-adjusted from my point of view, and she just comes to see me to say, "I just need to talk to you because I just don't know how I'm going to get through the funeral." And she said, "I, you know, Marcia," and she told me all that we went, it's all these terrible things that had happened to her. She said, "You know, I thought I'd get a break, but I didn't. And so we're going to make the best life we can with what we have." Now, if that isn't cured, I really don't know what is. And I see her now on a not a regular, once a year, so I'm talking to her to get her through her child. So I think there are many like that. The length of treatment really depends on how catastrophic the environment was and how catastrophic the disorder is and how catastrophic all the previous treatments were. Because, you know, some of those treatments are really catastrophic in themselves. And so you can have people come in and they breeze right through. And you have people who come in and it's much more long-term. But the research on borderline personality disorder is absolutely curable. Let me say something about therapists, because I have a lot of people call me tell me on the phone they're borderline personality disorder and they want to come in my program. And I'll tell you exactly what I tell them. I say, look, if you meet criteria for borderline right now, or you just got out of being borderline, coming and studying with me is not a good idea. You're going to watch patients in therapy. You're going to yearn to have the care and love and affection that they have. It's going to be difficult. Go to graduate school in a different area. Go to clinical and come to a postdoc with me. So I'm very, you know, there's no good reason to believe anybody with any disorder won't make a really good therapist. I think what you have to do is learn how to manage yourself, because if you're volatile and your patient's volatile, it could be trouble.
There are several questions here.
Other people have other opinions?
No, I agree completely. There's several questions here about when patients self-invalidate and handling that. So maybe I'll take this, because a couple of these are directly in response to my idea of blocking and redirecting. So if somebody says something like, "I'm a bad person," what in the world is valid about that? What could we validate about that? And of course, we don't want to certainly validate the content. We don't. And so I think there are many answers to that, and we can expand beyond me, but the short answer is just thinking about the coding, and what we're finding is that we want to find what's the valid piece of that? Well, it's ontologically valid. Right now, you are experiencing yourself as a bad person. You're maybe doing that cognitively, maybe it's just as an experience, maybe you're just feeling full of shame. You're feeling it, you're thinking it, something like that. That's the valid part. Not that, and however you got there is probably valid. Maybe that's something that a lot of people have told you, or maybe there have been some other models, who knows. But there's a way that you got there that's valid. And there's the and, of course, what I would say to this person is one of two things. I would say, you know, either there's no such thing as a bad person, is probably what I would actually say, because in a mindful world, there's no good or bad people. They're just people. And I'd say, you're a person, I'm a person, and we're the same. And so if you're a bad person, that means you're doing something with your person. Let's figure out what that is. And if it's painful, let's try to change it. Okay, so that's probably what I would say. And so I would try to validate the valid part, which is you are having that experience. So it's valid ontologically, but it's not valid in other ways. That's probably what I would do.
You know, I'd probably do the same thing if a person said that. I'm not sure I'd do it so skillfully, but I'd probably do it. But the main
I wouldn't do it skillfully at the moment either.
But the main thing that happens with me is not that people say I'm a bad person, is that they say I'm sorry, oh, I don't want to take up your time, oh, this is a stupid question, I know I'm silly, I know this is not worth it, I know this is really stupid, that kind of stuff. So the way we manage that ordinarily in DBT is we just say start over. Okay, we just basically say, okay, we give them an orientation at the beginning, and we say self-put-downs are not going to be helpful to you, so start over. And do it again without that. Now, I have discovered that therapists have this same tendency. They come in and say the same stuff where? On team. So we have the therapist start over on team. And I've now discovered it's really terrible. I've got to tell you, my behavior's gotten problematic. Because now I have people come up who want an autograph, and they say, I'll do this really quickly. I don't want to take up your time. And I say, start over. As if somehow, just to let the people who do autographs know, when famous people have come to see me, who I had their books since graduate school, this was my reaction. I'm so excited you're here. Will you give me an autograph? Please, oh, here. I've got two copies. Do you mind? Please do that. I'm telling you, I'm so excited I can hardly stand it. And I get autographs from them. So I've never thought it was stupid to get autographs, just to let you know.
Exactly. Okay. So, let's see. There's a couple of questions, I think, here, Marcia, for you, having to do with limits and the nature of the therapeutic relationship. So you had mentioned this morning that you could be a friend with a patient. And is this different than a patient-therapy relationship, or are you saying that it's a dual relationship, you're a therapist and a friend? Or maybe just to say it differently, could you comment on that? And what the limits might be, for example, in giving somebody a ride home or something like that. How do you decide?
You know, there is no one-size-fits-all, so there's really no one-size-fits-all answer. Let's start with that. But in many ways, I mean, the question is my mother my friend? Is my sister my friend? You know, I consider my sister my actual best friend. Okay. Katie works for me. Is Katie my friend? She's my employee, actually. I'm her boss. But I think of her as a friend also. So the thing to remember is that a dual relationship? So it all depends on what you mean by the word friend. Okay. In terms of a social friendship, which is to say seeing a client socially, I would have to say that ordinarily I do not do that. Mainly because for me personally, I think it really would cause problems. However, I belonged for a long time to a church which put their own clinic in solely so that their people who went to that church could do therapy with people who went to that church, so that they were all friends and did therapy with each other. And in small towns, it happens all the time. And so you can't really make up these rules about what you're going to do and not do. But I will say the following about... So would I take a client home? I have to say it would depend, actually. I mean, there's some clients I might take home. I once took a client home, or I had a client take me home, mainly because I wanted to see. She was so totally dysfunctional in a session. And I couldn't believe she could drive home. And then I discovered she became totally functional the second she hit the car, which meant the minute she left my office. And so, but more importantly, I think maybe is friendship after therapy. And I literally just had a whole discussion with my grad students about this. And I said to them, and I'll say to you, and this is what I believe. You cannot demand friendship. You can't decide you're going to be somebody's friend. In this sense, you can decide you will act friendly, be kind, loving, compassionate, and all that. But you can't decide, you know, friendship has that intangible part of a relationship, which those can only grow over time. They develop. They either do develop or they don't develop. So I have extremely close friends with a relationship with some of my clients, former clients. I wouldn't say offhand that I'm close friends with any of them. But I do have to say with people who've been my therapists in the past, I'm extremely close friends with them, and I stay at their house, they stay at my house, they call me, I call them, we could go on vacations together, we're extremely close. So I think there's no rules on this except that when you're a therapist, your number one priority is you must at all times operate in the best interest of the client. So as I say to my clients, I say, look, here's the deal. They say, you're not a friend. You're only helping me because you're a therapist. And I say, let me be clear. Here's the way it goes. What you're really paying for is my half of the hour. I said, you know, I'm helping you in half, and I'm not asking you to help me in the other half because you're paying me. In other words, because I'm your therapist. In other words, we have to operate in their best interest. When you're not a therapist, you don't have to operate in the best interest of another person except as your spirituality, religion, or humanity dictates. So I don't know. Do you have other things? I don't know. It's such a long question. But I'm in favor. I'm not against. I am utterly opposed to anyone saying you cannot have a relationship with a person after therapy. If you want to really get me going, you can get me to talk more about this topic. I consider the very idea that I would lose my ability to decide who my friends are solely by going into therapy. You can imagine what I think about that.
Just a caveat. I agree with Marcia. And a caveat, because I want to talk about while the person still is in therapy. I think that in DBT, and I'd like to hear other people's opinions, but the way I talk about this with my team and when I teach is to think that anything that you wouldn't want to bring to your team, you shouldn't do. You know? And so sunshine's a good indicator. And if you have any worries, the team is the place to talk about it and a place to problem solve it. And, I gave a patient a ride home the other day. We were having a blizzard, and she had tennis shoes on and was about to have to walk, a mile from the bus. And I know where she lives. It was on my way. And I didn't have any trouble talking about that with my team, mentioning it along the way. Anybody had any worries I could talk about, And so there's a sunshine kind of quality to it. But it's not being only the therapist, but also a human being, not leaving the human being behind when we become somebody's therapist. There's no need to have to create a false dichotomy there. That's my two cents on it anyway.
I would totally agree with what's been said, and I would just say that it's not talked about enough, and so there is just this shame or stigma, or you're doing something wrong if you kind of go in this direction. And so I do think a team is super important about this, because it can be hard to know what your own motivations are and to make sure you're, straight, right with things. So I think that's good. But I have, one of my dearest friends is somebody I did therapy with many years ago. And there's just a bond when somebody gets it together that's different. And you have to talk it through. You have to talk it through. What is it like, given that you used to have the power differential that was in your relationship and all the rest? It's not like it's super duper easy. And at the same time, it's real. So I just think it's complicated. And if you're clear and you're open, then it can work out. Yeah.
I think the issue being friends, I think the problem almost always is that a client very often wants to be my friend because they're often alone, lonely, and have no one else. And I'm faced with, you know, if I'm doing a lot of therapy, say 10 people who want that. And everybody knows that outside of therapy, having two friends in town is a stretch. And so I'm not particularly available for a whole lot of extra friendships that take up my time at least. So there's that factor. There's a limit on the therapy. But I do believe that we have become somewhat nuts in all these rules about you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't go there. My students, at least, are told they have to have permission, you know, to even go meet a client outside. And I think we've made up a lot of these rules really for the benefit of the therapist so that we can bring them in, check them out, bring them in, ship them out like this and have them come in and out. And it's convenient. But the fact that I take someone home or the fact that I meet them at a restaurant for a session, you know, social workers, just to be clear, and who do treatment and case management have been doing all of this since the beginning of time. And it's totally normal in other professions. Nurses do home visits. So it really, it becomes also an issue of your training and what discipline you happen to be in. And I'm more the social work nurse approach, at any rate.
We're almost out of time. I've got one question that I think is relatively brief here about what age groups, for what age groups is DBT appropriate? What about children, school-age children, you know, say 4, 5 to 12 years old? And what about seniors? DBT for these two ends of the age spectrum? Anybody thoughts?
The data is that Tom Lynch has done it with the elderly and did skills. They have a skills training program at Yale that they're developing for, I think it's 5 to 9 or 5 to 12 or something like that. There's a lot of DBT for adolescents. There's not a randomized trial. They're controlled trials. We're doing a randomized. They're doing a randomized in Norway also. I happen to know someone else who decided to teach DBT mindfulness skills to kindergartners. It was just too brilliant for words, if I do say so myself. And so the skills are, and we've got at the University of Washington Department of Education, they're trying to make up teacher guidelines for taking skills into the classroom in junior high. So the skills go everywhere because they're really, you know, normative. I mean, they're just good skills, basically. And the treatment, the data on the treatment is primarily adults, elderly with skills, and we're getting it for adolescents. And the Yale group are doing pilot stuff on children, and they're going to move to children and their families.
Okay. We're out of time, so there are some questions we didn't get to answer. I'm sorry. I don't know if folks will stick around down front to chat with you a little bit about that. So I want to, first of all, thank our both brilliant and compassionate presenters today. First.